Opinion vertical line to ways of looking at the West's population dilemma. The New York Times, November 3, 2023, 12:50 p.m. Get credit. Elaine Thielen shared full article by Ross Douthat, her opinion columnist. Window.unload equals functioned in my Wednesday column. I wrote about the various unveilings and intimations of new alignments that have accompanied the Israel-Gaza crisis, with one revealed being the extent to which immigration is transforming European politics, forging a mass movement of Arab Muslim protest that in turn may be driving European voters and even European elites toward the anti-immigration right. However you react to that description, whether it inspires anxiety about assimilation or anxiety about xenophobia, it should be accompanied by a large reminding asterisk: this is only the beginning. That is to say, whatever you see happening in Europe now is just the initial stage of the defining world revolution of the 21st century. The rapid graying of rich countries and soon, not so rich ones joined to the great migrations from the more youthful regions of the world. I want to recommend two windows into this incipient revolution. One is the first installment of a series from my newsroom colleague Declan Walsh about Africa's youthquake, the surge in population growth that's going to give the continent the world's largest workforce within the next decade. Two out of every five babies born worldwide by the 2040s, at least a third of the globe's 15 to 24-year-olds by 2050. Along with Walsh's reportage on the promise and peril of this boom for Africa itself, and some amazing photos from Hanarez Morales, the piece is worth reading if you still need to be disabused of the notion that the 21st century will exactly resemble the prophecies of overpopulated doom. From the 1970s, with teeming masses overwhelming resource-strapped countries everywhere. In fact, Africa with its youthquake is increasingly a global outlier. Much of East Asia, Latin America and the Middle East have a median age that's rising and converging with Europe's and North America's. And what's most striking about Africa's situation is not some general Malthusian crisis, but the geographic-demographic imbalance, the deep and inherently unstable divide between the African continent's youth and poverty and the rich and aging European continent to the north. That means the dilemma of the 21st century isn't how Earth will feed an ever-growing population, but how the world will deal with a potential mass rebalancing of population via migration, an altered wealth and people equilibrium, in a world where technology is making the movement of peoples easier than ever. The hopeful way to view this transformation is as a win-win. African countries have a vital resource that aging societies are losing, the youthful population, is how Walsh puts it, and you can imagine the future as an acceleration in the exchange of resources, with younger African workers going north and sending remittances south to help boost the developing economies they leave behind. But it won't be that simple. For one thing, as you see already in European migrant preferences, migrants don't necessarily want to go to every aging country. They want to get to the richest or most dynamic or most generous ones, better Italy and Spain than Bulgaria or Romania, better Germany and Sweden than Italy or Spain. So some aging countries, the not as rich ones, are likely to see continued emigration by their own young people. This is Ukraine's dilemma, accelerated by war rather than a simple replenishment by immigrants from Nigeria or Morocco or anywhere else. This may also be true in the Americas, as demographic decline sets in across Latin America. Birth rates are well below replacement in several Latin American countries. You won't necessarily see an end to northward migration, rather, the driven and ambitious will continue to try to reach the United States, and stagnation may set in or deepen in the countries that they leave behind. Clearly, the richest countries will be able to replenish their populations with immigration across the 21st century if they choose. But the anxiety of Europeans right now over their existing minority populations taking to the streets to protest for Palestine or, it's feared, for Hamas and the punitive measures, like littoral neighborhood demolitions, already being taken in countries like Denmark to try to break up immigrant enclaves, are just a foretaste of the political turbulence inherent in that kind of transformation. Because, again, the scale of what we're talking about, the interaction between migration pressures and low birth rates, is not mass immigration as we knew it 50 years ago. Here it's worth reading a new paper by Paul Moreland and Philip Pilkington, respectively the demographer and an economist, modeling Britain's economic and demographic future. Britain had below replacement fertility for about half a century, and it's been relying on unprecedented immigration rates to supply younger workers by a very long way the fastest ethnic change the country has seen, not since the Norman conquests of the 11th century, but rather since the Anglo-Saxons arrived in the 5th century, or maybe earlier still. That's what happened already, and it hasn't prevented Britain from already slipping a bit into economic stagnation. Here it's also important to stress that when you rely on immigration for younger workers, it's not a one-off solution. If your birth rates stay low, you have to keep finding new immigrants, because immigrants don't all come as 18-year-olds. They themselves age and become retirees. Their own birth rates converge with natives, and they often bring their older relatives after them. What will happen, though, is something much more dramatic. According to Moreland and Pilkington's projections, if current birth rates hold in Britain, within 50 years, more than a third of the country's population would need to be first-generation immigrants to keep the old age dependency ratio around 40%. A 25% ratio means there are 4 workers for every retiree, a 50% ratio, just 2. If birth rates slump much further, toward the dire level seen in a country like South Korea, to maintain a sustainable dependency ratio in the late 21st century, more than half of Britain's population would need to be first-generation immigrants. I don't think you need to be especially pessimistic to regard that kind of transformation as incompatible with stable democratic governance. It's among the reasons you already have the rightward shift in European politics, and why immigration restriction will be a winning issue for the foreseeable future in many European countries. But a rightward and anti-immigration shift without some novel source of people, Moreland and Pilkington point out, yields the European equivalent of what we see already in Japan: a cultural preservationism linked to steady economic decline. This is an alternative that some on the degrowth left and nativist right might explicitly favor. But I am very skeptical that simply choosing the stagnant preservationism will be sustainable for rich countries that aren't islands off the northeast coast of Asia, and even Japan may yet be transformed. Europe is geographically adjacent to the African youth quake. It already has many channels for migrants to enter, along with substantial existing immigrant communities to help welcome them and immediate economic opportunities for new arrivals. Whatever migration's potentially destabilizing effects in the longer term, there's a reason even right-wing governments in places like Italy and Poland have struggled to make restrictions stick. It's not that I think borders inherently can't be enforced or that immigration can't be restricted and redirected. Clearly policy matters, as you can see just in the differences between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. But the circumstances of the 21st century are going to be highly unusual by historical standards. Europe's situation is different from America's, and I think conservatives and immigration restrictionists who imagine that it's simply a matter of will are going to find that even a much more right-wing continent will end up looking more like Moreland and Pilkington's scenario of rapid and destabilizing demographic transformation than like contemporary Japan. There is, of course, another possibility, which is that dynamism could be restored by higher birth rates, a more children option, which would render immigration less economically necessary while perhaps also making substantial immigrant populations less threatening to natives and more easily assimilated. The question of how you raise birth rates is one I've taken up before and will doubtless take up again after I figure out how to increase the marriage rate, of course. But to bring this newsletter back, in a sense, to where it began, I'll end here by quoting Moreland and Pilkington: the only country in the OECD that has chosen the more children option is Israel. Breviary Gilbert Mailander on Posthumanism and the Audacity of Birth. Blake Smith on Humanists at Sea in the Age of Climate Change. Yuan Yizhu on the Jingoatlantic Colonial History. Valerie Stivers on Cat Person as Fairy Tales. Tim Miller on Mississippi's Surprising Democrat. John Gallagher on the Hawkers of London. This week in Anti-Decadence: despite the widely held belief that dementia is destined to rise exponentially as global populations age, experts believe that, in the developed world at least, the prospects of avoiding dementia are stronger than they were a generation ago. A study published in 2020, which drew together multiple pieces of research to track the health of almost 50,000 over 65s, showed the incidence rate of new cases of dementia in Europe and North America had dropped 13% per decade over the past 25 years, a decline that was consistent across all the studies. Now, there are early signs that the same phenomenon may be emerging in Japan, a striking development in one of the world's most aged populations, suggesting that the downward trend is becoming more widespread. Sarah Neville, what is behind the unexpected decline in dementia? The Financial Times October 30. Ross Douthat has been an opinion columnist for The Times since 2009. He is the author, most recently, of Event Number 8220, The Deep Places, A Memoir of Illness and Discovery. And Number 8221, at Douthat NYD Facebook Share Full Article.